I never have needed psychoanalytic professionalism as much as in these very unconventional situations. And I think it took the women out of the shock, out of this freezing psychic state, and to meet a human being who dares to try to stand the horror what she had gone through. I think that was essential for her.
Welcome to the IPA podcast, Psychoanalysis on and off the couch. This is a podcast in which we will discover the world of psychoanalysis that lives beyond the couch, beyond the individual consultation room. We will meet psychoanalysts who work in dialysis units, prenatal clinics, corporate boardrooms, community centers, humanitarian organizations, and with vineyard workers, just to name a few. We hope these conversations expand our awareness of how broadly psychoanalytic thinking extends into our communities. Come listen, enjoy, and please share your comments on the webpage, ipaoffthecouch.org. Welcome to today's podcast. I'm Harvey Schwartz. I'm an analyst on the faculty of the Psychoanalytic Association of New York and the Psychoanalytic Center of Philadelphia. My guest today is Dr. Marianne Leutzinger-Bolibar. She is a training analyst at the German Psychoanalytic Association and a member of the Swiss Psychoanalytical Society. She is a recipient of the Sigourney Award in 2016 and the Haskell Norman Prize for Excellence in Psychoanalysis in 2017. From 2001 to 2016, she was the director in charge of the Sigmund Freud Institute in Frankfurt, Germany. From 2001 to 2009, she was chair of the IPA research subcommittees for conceptual research. Her research fields are clinical and extraclinical research in psychoanalysis, psychoanalytical developmental research, prevention studies, interdisciplinary dialogue between psychoanalysis and literature, educational sciences, and the neurosciences. In today's interview, you will learn, as I did, of what Marianne feels is her psychoanalytic spirit, because she brings it forward in all of her clinical encounters. She brings with her a deep, warm, empathic humanity and a wise clinical ear and judgment. It's a real pleasure, and I hope you enjoy our talk together. Marianne, welcome to the podcast.
Welcome. Also, thank you for calling me.
I find the prospect daunting of bringing a psychoanalytic perspective to a humanitarian crisis as enormous as the German refugee situation is today. Yet, it also occurs to me that given our knowledge and experience with trauma and loss, that we have something to contribute. When you and I first started speaking with each other in preparation for this interview, your associations went almost immediately from the issue of the refugees to the Holocaust and how you felt the Holocaust lived in the current psyche of the German community. And from that, it went to your own clinical experiences working with children of survivors and children of Nazis. Marianne, if I could ask you to be so generous with your thinking, to share with us your reflections on these associations of yours and how you feel it informs the current both social situation and also the clinical situation with which you and the therapist you work with are facing in working with refugees, and also what it was like in Germany in 2015 and 16 when there were up to 2 million refugees on the border.
Well, thank you. In fact, 2015 was a very specific political, cultural, and historical situation. Surely you remember that in summer 2015.
Sure.
Tens of thousands of refugees, many from Syria, Afghanistan, but also from war zones in Africa, flocked to Europe in temporary life-threatening boats. They came across the Mediterranean Sea and on foot along the so-called Balkan route. To this day, the majority of Germans agree that Angela Merkel, the German chancellor of the country responsible for the European catastrophe of the Second World War and the Holocaust, could not turn these people in despair and existential threat away. It was absolutely not possible for fences to be erected once again in history to expose people to death and annihilation. And that, of course, was my first association when you ask me. Most of the people in Germany, and also me and, of course, my psychoanalytical colleagues, understood this situation spontaneously. And the willingness to help, the so-called welcome culture, was just overwhelming. Many, especially the elderly, remembered their own fate as refugees. 14.5 million in the 1950s sought protection, survival, and some new future in the very destroyed post-war Germany at that time.
You know, non-Germans don't know that as we might and should. We don't think of the Germans themselves as the refugees, only the perpetrators of causing others to be refugees.
Yeah, but many of the older people, you know, when they saw these pictures of these lines and lines of refugees, children, women, and they were had memories of their own fates. And of course, the Holocaust is still very present in Germany, and a wound that can never really be closed. Therefore, it was reminded us like a kind of collective attempt at healing that the Germans were no longer, during these weeks, the murderers, the Nazis, who had brought unimaginable destruction, death, and suffering to millions of Jews and other marginalized groups, but also to the whole Europe, you know. And they were once in history for a few months, the good, the helping, and the human ones. And this played an enormous role. But as you know, tragically, it took only a few weeks until the dark side, the split and the repressed, also came to the first surface. And for me, it was just hardly to stand to see and to believe that this, that exactly in Germany, the shelter of refugees were lit on fire again. And as you know, in the meantime, there is a split in society, as in many other Western countries, between still a large group of the population that cares for the refugees with empathy and helpfulness, and others, even a whole party, the AfD, Alternative for Germany, who want to isolate Europe and to stimulate a new deeply rooted hostility towards foreigners, right-wing nationalistic ideas, and also anti-Semitism, which are especially shaped by German history. And this is a very scaring and a sad and dangerous development. And of course, it's very much on our mind as psychoanalysts, because I think we are experts on individual but also collective history. That is one thing of this, on the societal dimension. But of course, I have a real Swiss accent, you know, and living here in Germany, and that was recognized by my analysis, mostly unconsciously often. And so some of them unconsciously, they choose me as their analyst because they thought, as a Swiss, I'm not so much involved in National Socialism. And therefore, I had the second generation patients from Holocaust families, as well as from persecutor families or bystanders, which was a very intensive experience. And to make a long story short, of course, also for me personally, as an analyst, I had seen the shadows of such man-made disasters and extreme traumatization for generations, you know, not only for the direct survivors, but also for the children and even the grandchildren. When we saw these refugees, immediately, of course, we were also thinking of these shadows, and we wanted to try to do at least what we can, that the acute trauma of these refugees was just not given to the next generation in a very unbroken sense.
to try to break the intergenerational transmission of the trauma.
Absolutely. That was, of course, the attempt. I mean, in some single cases, I think we really could do, because we know that from Holocaust research that the first reaction to trauma, of course, is very essential.
You've set up a step-by-step program, which is designed to bring, tell me if I have this correct, to bring psychoanalytic sensitivities to large groups of people. Can you share with us what the step-by-step program is?
It, of course, it is very much connected to the situation in 2015, because the Ministry of State of Hessen approached me as a director of the Sigmund Freud Institute at that time, because they didn't practically didn't know what to do with this millions of refugees. And of course, there was, after a few weeks, you know, they put all the refugees in so big institutions. And then, of course, you can imagine what happened. Particularly, there were a lot of men between 20 and 30 years. And there was violence there, even rapes. And so the politicians were scared. And they approached me because the Sigmund Freud Institute has a very famous history and is connected to the Holocaust and to the National Socialist topic very closely. I don't think I can go into it, but even its existence, it depended on this history, because it was founded in 1960 as a gesture of kind of reparation of the German government towards psychoanalysis, to bring psychoanalysis as a Jewish science, as they said, back to Germany. But that's another story. But so the institute was very much connected to trauma. And for different reasons, when I was a director, I tried to take up this specific tradition of this institution connected to collective and individual trauma and persecution. And I was responsible for several large prevention projects in problematic regions here in Frankfurt, trying to help severely traumatized families and their children, often migrants and refugees, to help or to support them. And we had 3,000 of these families in a cluster randomized study. And that's why the German government had also kind of a fig leaf to approach exactly our institution. You know, that is a political decision. But then, of course, the situation was highly dramatic, and they wanted us to conceptualize a pilot study and to evaluate it in a first reception camp where about 800 refugees were living first in tents and afterwards in a village. And of course, it was a very chaotic situation. So it was a real challenge. I did it together with a colleague, Sabine Andresen, a professor for educational sciences. And we tried to use our knowledge on trauma, me as an analyst and she as an educational scientist, to make a project, and we called it Step by Step, in order to help all the people who were working in this institution to approach the acute traumatized refugees, and particularly the families and the young mothers and the small children, to try to prevent that they had kind of a re-traumatization after arriving here.
You had mentioned that there were males that were violent. Were they included in this work?
Well, that was one political decision they made. You know, the adolescents which were traveling alone without their families, they put them into other institutions. And we called it the village. We didn't want to call it camp. In Germany, a camp has this historical association. We used the term Michaelisdorf, the village, and try to make it to a social meeting place. And there in the buildings, we separated the families, the single mothers with the babies, the young girls from the males. We also had males. That was an organizational structure. But I really tried to bring in the psychoanalytic concept and spirit, you know, that trying not to deny the trauma. You don't believe how this is ubiquitous. People don't want to see the trauma. They want to look away. They don't want to be confronted with all what mankind can do to other mankinds. It's a denial. So we made a lot of educational work and supervision for all the groups who are working there, from the doctors to the social workers to the administrative persons, even to the security person, and try to educate them what trauma means, that it is a situation of being overflooded with death anxiety and despair, extreme situation which you cannot stand, and that your basic trust in a helping other and in your self-agency breaks down. That was important to tell the people because, you know, they had simplified perceptions of the refugees and, of course, own defenses of not wanting really to cope with them. So we developed several principles. I don't know if we have the room, the space to talk about it. For instance, that the first thing was that the refugees absolutely need reliable, predictable structures in the everyday situation. That meant that we built up first a pictogram, because, you know, the people, they couldn't communicate because they didn't speak the language. A pictogram which gave them an orientation on the village, you know, where the sleeping rooms are, where the medical doctors are, and so on. You know, that they had a local orientation. And then we offered them different modules that came out of trauma research also, because, you know, traumatized people, they shouldn't get into a passive situation. It's very important to get them into activity. So we offered them courses, language courses, courses for children. We had a therapeutic painting group for children and adolescents. We had several adolescent groups. I myself offered a weekly psychoanalytic consultation hour and so on. So each refugee should select for each day at least a two-hour activity, but then also participate, give something back at least 2 hours a day in order to contribute to the village. You know, we tried to kind of help them to find their own identity and self again, not to be just a refugee. You know, we had everything. We had, of course, analphabets from Syria, but we had a pianist, a concert pianist, and translators. We had all, and we tried to motivate them to give something back. For instance, the pianist gave concerts, you know. The professor for Americanistic, she gave courses in English, and so on. So to try to get them into activity and to find their dignity again. But besides that, we offered supervision to all the groups who were there, which was essential because we know, you know, working with traumatized, you are kind of, how do you say in English, you are infected by the trauma.
They call it secondary trauma, yes.
Yeah, secondary. So we tried to help them to stand, to stand this feeling, to recognize them, to accept them, and also to help them to empathize. You know, they said, well, we cannot communicate with them. We don't have language. And of course, I tried to tell them that traumatized people, they wouldn't have survived if they wouldn't have kind of developed very, very sensitive antennas to recognize the nonverbal bodily language. You know, we know that from experience of the Holocaust survivors in the camps for displaced persons in Germany. You know, when they were treated in a sadistical, cold way again, nonverbally, that they lost their hope. And we had a lot of suicides, yeah? So we tried to tell them. And also, you know, we had small groups of supervision where we even showed them examples that, of course, the refugees, they will recognize if the security person has a sadistic impulse to put them away, or if he's interested and he empathizes with the pain and what these people had gone through.
Sure. Let me ask you about these cultural tensions that you're describing. I can only imagine, and of course I really can't, what it was like for so many of these refugees that came from a background that had its own particular view towards homosexuality, towards women's autonomy, towards Jews, towards Christians. They bring their own backgrounds, and it must be quite challenging for them to suddenly find themselves in the midst of a modern culture where the views are not shared by them about such people. And likewise for the therapists we're all familiar with working cross-culturally on the couch, but this is different. This is really off the couch. And what it's like for the therapists, many of whom are, like I say, are from those demographics, to encounter people who start off with questions, suspicions, antagonisms. Let me know if my characterizations you feel are correct, and if they are, how it was negotiated by both parties in the dyads.
Oh, yes, it's a big problem. I think you are talking now about the therapies. You know, Step by Step was a project where we were having the first step, you know, in the crisis intervention. I was surprised because, you know, if you have gone through extreme traumatization, that has such a quality that I think the cultural dimension, to my surprise, was not very relevant. You know, it was just fear of death. And we will talk about an example afterwards, you know. And I think that we were confronted with kind of the existential dimension of human existence. In this acute situation, the cultural dimension, it played a role, but it was not so essential. But in the second step, you know, we tried to organize as good as we can that, of course, many of these people, they needed therapies afterwards, second steps. And we have now that is very, very good that, you know, the pilot project was very good evaluated. So the state of Hessen established 4 psychosocial centers, he called it, where therapy for a longer term is offered. And there my colleagues and I myself are working in kind of longer therapies with the refugees, and there, of course, the culture problem is enormous. You mentioned, for instance, homosexuality. Well, it's one of these cruel things the torturers all over the world seem to know. You know, we had several adolescents who were raped homosexually during the flight, which is for a Muslim young man a terrible denigration. For instance, and often, you know, they were only able to talk about this after basic trust had been established, of course, in the analytic. And we had to make this topic it's complex, but we have several organizations here in Frankfurt who have worked with refugees therapeutically and psychoanalytically already for 20 years, you know, after the Yugoslavia war. And they have collected a lot of these culture sensitive topics, and they organized courses and supervision now for the therapists and the analysts who are taking refugees in treatment.
How valuable. Wow. Can you share with us a particular clinical situation that will help us feel your analytic approach to this situation?
Well, perhaps then I start with a short example from the Michaelis village, because I was really uncertain if we as psychoanalysts, you know, normally working for hundreds of sessions with one patient, can really offer something helpful in the acute state. And I was surprised it really was, because these people were often in a shock. For instance, I'm thinking of a woman who was, you know, I was there for 2 years, one day a week, and we had a good cooperation with the social workers. So I tried to make them sensitive for acute situations. You know, for instance, many of these people, like, for instance, Mrs. B, she withdrew. She didn't come to get her meals. She was wandering around during the night. and she was in a terrible state. You know, I trained them to, for instance, to recognize what we call the frozen face, you know, which is one symptom of an acute traumatization. So they brought me this woman to my consultation with a translator, and she looked very pale, very disturbed, and she had all the signs of a frozen face. She sat down, and was often the case, she didn't talk for a long while. And as an analyst, I tried to observe my countertransference as good as I could. And this is often, was often hardly to bear, you know. I felt this terrible emptiness, this horror, the shock, and the metaphors of my colleagues who were talking about the Holocaust came to my mind, you know, the empty circle of Dori Laub or the black hole of Eleni Kogan. I just was silent about 10 minutes. And then when I was recognized that it was probably a severe trauma, and then I stumbled something, well, I see that you don't feel well and you must have gone through terrible things. And that was the first time that she looked at me and I saw that tears started to roll over her cheeks. The translator then took her into her arm and said, stop asking her, stop asking her. But I said, well, but maybe it's better she can cry than she is in such a shock. And then she started to tell me that she comes from Syria and her husband sent her away with the three smallest children, and he stayed there with four elder ones. And all three children were drowned in the Mediterranean Sea. And of course, she started to talk about that, and she started to cry terribly. And I must say, I had the same feelings. How can you stand the situation that you have lost three children and seeing them drown? And then she told me that she's pregnant in the eighth month, and that she has complications. And I said, well, after what you have gone through, of course you are afraid to get another child. And we were talking about her guilt feelings and her being terrified of the birth, of the situation, of losing the control, but also in a very cautious way about her resentment and hate that she felt so abandoned by her husband, who had, in the meantime, he was in Greece with the four other children, and she felt so abandoned from him. And it was important that I helped her to verbalize this. And then we tried to find a solution for the birth. And at that time, it was still a politically openness. So I asked her if she knows anybody in Germany, of course, and my knowledge about birth, my psychoanalytic knowledge, played a role. And then we found out that she has a cousin in another part of Germany. We called her and I asked this cousin if she was willing to help these women preparing the birth and being with her during the birth. And then in this acute situation, you know, we had to organize. It was very practical. But I saw her several times, and I worked with her as an analyst on her guilt feeling. And, you know, she was very suicidal. She didn't want to live anymore. And I think unconsciously she even hoped that she would die giving birth to the child. And also the hatred of the husband who made her so many children. I had forgotten that they had to flee because the IS threatened her. And, you know, that is also a very important dimension to tell her that it was not her guilt that she had to live with the children, but she tried to save the life of these children. She felt responsible for their death, but she wasn't indeed.
And your intervention was useful, it sounds like.
Yes. See, she became into more activity, and Of course, the essential thing was that her cousin, you know, being also a foreigner, but she lived in Germany. She had been there for several years, so she knew the German culture a little bit. And then she accompanied her during the birth. I think that was the main reason why she had a normal child and survived birth.
Let me just suggest that you and I and the listeners not minimize the impact of your remarkable gentleness in even recounting the story, much less living through it. And I can only imagine that that meant the world to this woman. It's not just our words, it's our being.
I think it probably did. I was so grateful to psychoanalysis. I think I often had the feeling I never have needed the psychoanalytic professionalism. As much as in these very unconventional situations. And I think it took the women out of the shock, out of this freezing psychic state. And of course, she will need a lot of help. And that is, of course, not the healing or something like that. But in the acute situation, just to meet a human being who dares to try to stand the horror what she had gone through, I think that was essential for her.
I have absolutely no doubt about that. I'm hesitant to ask something with such a different rhythm, but I do want to include, I want to recognize and also invite you to share, in addition to everything you've just described, you do empirical research on the outcome of this important work. And that's as vital, I think, as the deeply human intimacy that is also set up with these individuals. Can you share with us what you've learned from the empirical research?
Well, it was, of course, what we call a formative evaluation. It was a very special method suited to evaluate if the project was accepted by the refugees. You know, we were not sure if our psychoanalytical offer, which is, of course, very different from other offers, you know, coming from cognitive behavioral traditions, which are much more technical, trying to make the effects disappear. I say it now much too simplified. I mean, the psychoanalytical approach is trying to cope with the trauma and trying to give it a visualization, a language, you know, trying to kind of symbolize the trauma. Very different approach, which is for politicians often quite strange. And so when we could show, for instance, that more than 80% of all the refugees in this Michaelisdorf, they regularly took part of one of these offers, you know, of one of the groups or my consultation hours. And we also could show that they started to be active, you know, that the Michaelisdorf, they really, it became a place of social interaction. And we didn't have violence, for instance. That was a very important thing, you know. So this is this kind of research, which was just important in order to give the politicians also the legitimation to build up these psychosocial centers, which are evaluated again by Patrick Moers. He's my successor at the Sigmund Freud Institute. He is responsible for this evaluation. But I don't know if you meant this with your question. I mean, the...
Well, yes. Have there been outcome studies in some fashion to indicate the impact of these interventions on the lives of these individuals?
You know, that takes a long time to do.
Sure.
We are still planning such a study. But, you know, I had another very impressive empirical lesson. You know, I was responsible for two outcome studies of psychoanalysis. The first one was in the 1990s. We made a follow-up study of 400 psychoanalytic long-term patients who had been in analysis with analysts of our association, the German Psychoanalytic Association. And one of the most surprising results that was that 62% of all the patients who had been in long-term treatment at that time were children of the war. That was very impressive. No one was talking about it, that it was even a taboo in Germany, understandably, because we first had to cope with the Holocaust survivors, you know, and their families. But that we also were living in a very traumatized society because of the children of the war. That was a very impressive finding, and we did it empirically in a very found way. Or now, we've just finished a large study on chronic depression, the so-called LUX study, a comparative study, really with randomization and very hard, kind of a rigid method. And an unexpected finding was that 84% of all these chronic depressed patients, and we saw several hundred of them, had a severe cumulative early trauma, which ended into chronic depression, which is, of course, a finding, a strong empirical finding, which shows the long-term consequences of early trauma. It has not directly to do with the refugees, but it is another population, and I think we have to take that very seriously.
Marianne, one of the ways you characterized your perspective on this work is to introduce to them a psychoanalytic spirit. I can tell you that I, as one listener, and I'm sure I'm speaking accurately for many other listeners, have been moved by your psychoanalytic spirit. It's deeply human, it's deeply thoughtful, it's deeply generous and movingly kind. And I want to thank you for letting me get to know you, your work, and for sharing it with those who are fortunate enough to listen to this.
Well, thank you. I hope my English was good enough to express something which is very complex. Of course, the refugee problem is of course, also a political one. And I mean, I think it's probably becoming one of the most urgent problems of our future, also due to the climate change. Yeah. I wish that psychoanalysis could do at least a little voice in the choir of many people are trying to help.
Your voice is quiet but very, very strong. Thank you so much.
Thank you, Harvey.
Thank you for listening. If I may, I'd like to ask you to help us publicize our podcast by rating us on iTunes or simply sharing it with a friend. You can also visit our webpage, ipaoffthecouch.org, where you can both subscribe and also add your comments. I'd also like to acknowledge the lovely rendition of Beethoven's Opus 18th String Quartet by the Allegri String Quartet on the Vivat label.